Hello, I'm Catherine Jansen, editor of Speculum, a journal of medieval studies. I'm delighted to welcome you to another episode of Speculum Spotlight, a collaboration with the Multicultural Middle Ages podcast. Each episode brings you behind the scenes to look at the making of an article published in our current issue, in this case, October 2024, the final issue of the year. In this episode, we spotlight a cluster of articles entitled The Textual Cult of Richard Rolla, Writing Contemplation in Late Medieval England, edited by Andrew Albin and Andrew Crable. The essays aim to reassess the work of the Hermit of Hampole in light of a generation of scholarship dedicated to this charismatic ascetic. They furthermore examine Rolla's construction as an eremitical writer and as a public contemplative. They also look at his critical reception by the laity, his spiritual heirs, and indeed by contemporary scholars. In the event, the essays are an invitation to all medievalists, not just literary scholars, to rediscover Rolla's works and contributions to the religious sensibility of later medieval England. The host and producer of this episode is Jonathan Correa Reyes, assistant professor of English at Clemson University. His research explores formulations of race and race thinking in medieval romances, and he has forthcoming articles in Speculum, Postmedieval, and Viator. His work has been supported by the Ford Foundation. Our guests today are Andrew Albin and Andrew Crable, the editors of the Rolla Cluster. Andrew Albin is Associate Professor of English and Medieval Studies at Fordham University at Lincoln Center. His scholarship studies what he calls the sonorous past. His first book, Richard Rolla's Melody of Love, A Study and Translation with Manuscript and Musical Contexts, was published by the Pontifical Institute of Medieval Studies in 2018. He is now at work on a book entitled The Manuscript is an Instrument and We Must Play. Albin also facilitates the Fordham Medieval Dramatists, New York City's only dedicated medieval performance ensemble, which will be presenting pageants from the York Cycle in the summer of 2025 at the University of Toronto's York Plays Festival. Andrew Crable is Associate Professor of English at Trinity University in San Antonio. He is the author of Biblical Commentary and Translation in Later Medieval England, Experiments in Interpretation, published by Cambridge University Press in 2020. He was awarded the Best First Book Prize by the Ecclesiastical History Society and the John Nicholas Brown Prize by the Medieval Academy of America. His critical edition and translation of Richard Rolla's Glosses on the Nine Lessons of the Dead is forthcoming from PIMS, and he has recently been awarded a multi-year grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities to support his work, together with Stephen Rosinski, on a new critical edition and translation of Rolla's Incendium Amoris, or Fire of Love. Let me now turn the mic over to John and the two Andrews. I'll see you on the other side.
Welcome, Andrew. We are so glad to have you here. Congratulations on the publication of this essay cluster that you both so generously edited.
Thank you.
Maybe we can start at the beginning. You dedicate this cluster of essays to Vincent Gillespie. As we begin our conversation, I'd like to invite you to speak about Professor Gillespie's impact as both a scholar and a mentor.
Sure. I think, you know, all of the contributors in the cluster have had some sort of relationship with Vincent over the course of our careers, whether that's, you know, as somebody who, when we're around the Bodleian, when we're doing research in Oxford, we run into him and we benefit from conversations with him, or I know some of our contributors were part of the MPhil program at Oxford when he was directing it, or I think master's students under his supervision or colleagues of his. For my part, I met him for the first time when I was an undergraduate doing a study abroad term in Oxford, and I was just in awe of a lecture of his that I attended. I think I went back to New Hampshire and read every single essay of his that I could get my hands on. And his intervention in the field is primarily essayistic, and it's like nothing else, right? He is so good at teasing out the way medieval religious writers, especially folks we would call medieval mystics, are playing with language and trying to cultivate specific effects to bring their readers along with them in some sort of, you know, devotional practice, some sort of devotional discipline. And I feel really lucky that I got to know him better in graduate school, and I count him as a friend and a colleague and mentor. I don't think there's anybody whose contribution has been like his. When we suggested this, everybody just said, yeah, let's do that. That's perfect.
Yeah. I mean, I think Andrew has a more direct and personal relationship just from having studied and spent time in the UK. I don't know Vincent as well directly, but I certainly know his work very, very well. When I first encountered Rolla in graduate school, Vincent's work was alongside everything that we read, right? It was the first point of contact. I mean, his Postcards from the Edge was like my first taste of a kind of scholarship that I just was deeply excited by. It does the thing of trying to get as close as we can get to experience of medieval people in this sort of rarefied space of religious experience, of mystical experience. And it does it through such ingenious readings of not just literary texts, but cultural contexts, antecedents, literary traditions, historical traditions, theological traditions, psychological and philosophical traditions. It's such a masterclass in the interdisciplinarity that is the hallmark of medieval studies. And it does it so stylishly.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's also just damn fun to read, right? Like, he's a funny guy. He's a stylish writer. He has the quip down. There's nothing like reading a Vincent Gillespie essay.
Your passion for his work is infectious. I don't know his work directly, but you have certainly made me curious. And what you describe is not easy. To tap into what religious experience could have been like is not an easy thing to accomplish. And if you feel that he can not only do that, but do it well in a fun and engaging way, that is just impressive.
I think Rolla is a particularly good candidate for doing that kind of work. He leaves us such an ample corpus of materials to think through, and that corpus is uncharacteristic for what we anticipate like religious writing and spiritual autobiography look like, in ways that really do push us to think about the experiential, in addition to in concert with, in dialogue with the literary or the written. And I think Vincent's very well attuned to what we can do creatively, critically, in that sort of dialogic space that sits in between the written word and the sort of lived experience, which is not a common feature. I mean, I think it's a really unique and valuable piece of what he contributes to the field.
Yeah, anybody who's interested can find in the introduction to our cluster, lots of his essays cited. I think one that isn't cited there that I would encourage everybody to look at is a piece he published in Mystics Quarterly, maybe a decade or two ago, called On Reading Julian of Norwich, which is amazing because it is, in part because it's co-written with Maggie Ross, who is a fantastic theological thinker and herself a recluse, a hermit. And it just is the result of them meeting regularly over the course of something like a year and reading Julian in small pieces and reflecting on it together and taping their conversations and then writing. It's an amazing kind of scholarship and a really, really good read.
So you already mentioned Richard Rolla, the medieval author at the heart of this cluster of essays. A term that's often invoked alongside the name of Rolla is mystical authority. Could you talk to us a bit about who was Richard Rolla and what it means to be a mystical authority?
I mean, I can maybe dive in a little bit here. So biographically, born around 1300, dies around 1349, probably as a result of the bubonic plague, son of workers of the land, comes into the sights of a future archbishop, but at this point, a young guy, probably around 16, 17 years old, and his family, and they take a shine to him and fund his studies at Oxford. And so he studies at Oxford for 3-4 years and decides this is too arid, it's too erudite, it's too disconnected from all the stuff that gets me interested and sort of fired up about what the devotional life is like, what leading a spiritually righteous life is like. And so he drops out of Oxford. And according to the narrative that we get in the office that was prepared at the end of the 14th century by the nunnery at Hampole, which is where later in life he settled and ministered to the female religious that were there, in that office, we get a sort of narrative of his meeting his sister after having dropped out of Oxford, having asked her to bring two cloaks and their father's rain hood. And he takes the two cloaks and sort of on the spot, sort of tears off the sleeves of one, pulls off the buttons of another, puts on the garments. His sister sort of maybe recognizes that he's doing something like trying to adopt a hermit's habit, but the story tells us...
My brother is out of his mind.
Exactly. The story tells us that he is crazy, and she runs off screaming to the people around her, he's gone crazy. And he runs off in the opposite direction and sort of disappears for a little while and then reappears in the biographical narrative we've got in the office in the chapel of a sort of local aristocrat in Yorkshire.
The notable thing is he's just fled from his sister, and like he shows up in a chapel, like hunched over in prayer. But that's the lady of the household seat. What are you doing there? But she's like, don't move him. He looks, I don't know, that he looks disturbed. No, he looks devout. And her sons recognize him from Oxford. And very quickly, you know, he gets brought back to their house for lunch the next day after Mass. And John Dalton, right, who is the bailiff of the Earl of Lancaster at Pickering, establishes him on the estate as a hermit under his sort of patronage. It's unclear how long he stays there, but he seems to be moving around Yorkshire, the Dales, occupying different cells, chapels, things like that, for much of the rest of his career.
And building relationships with other area aristocracy. It's sort of one of the really interesting things about Rolla. Is he a kind of misanthrope trying to avoid society and build this eremitic lifestyle of devotion? Is he a scrounger who's just like hopping from patron to patron and living off of their benefits? And he gets critiqued for this in the writings he builds later on in his career that are autobiographical writings. He records being critiqued by other monks and other religious for the kind of unorthodox hermit lifestyle that he has built. But yeah, I mean, eventually near the end of his life, builds this relationship with a Cistercian nunnery in Hampole in Yorkshire and provides spiritual counseling to the women religious there, and then passes away in 1349. And within what, 20 years or so, a local body of miracles starts to grow around his gravesite. His body is translated into a chapel in the nunnery, and the nunnery actually starts to make some real coin from attracting pilgrims to the site for miraculous healings and spiritual favor. And he becomes a pretty like revered local saint through the end of the Middle Ages.
It's unclear how long he had actually been at the Cistercian nunnery before it seems like the plague got him. It is also quite possible that this was the first time he had been there. So they really might have just lucked out getting this saint's body and building a cult around it.
And it's clear when there's been some really good scholarship built around this, but when we look at the historical records, that particular nunnery was not doing very well financially before Rolla kind of appeared in their midst. And so they're definitely involved in promoting the cult. The office that they build is very clearly a bid to get him canonized. And it's clear that like his texts are circulating internationally, right? They are connected to charterhouses through charterhouses and other sort of networks of manuscript transmission and transport. His books end up getting circulated to the Brigittine Motherhouse in Vadstena. They end up getting circulated to the Bohemian lands. They end up being brought to the Council of Constance and potentially being read and shared there. They're connected to the Hussite controversy in Bohemian lands. So he's certainly getting read outside of England, although in England, he becomes one of the most, probably the most influential local-born spiritual writers through the remainder of the Middle Ages, right? Every mystic who you read after Rolla has read Rolla, and oftentimes is directly either reacting to or citing and responding to Rolla in their writings. So, you know, he's sort of like a spiritual bestseller, if there is such a thing. He becomes part of the religious and literary fabric of England through the remainder of the Middle Ages.
Which is like another sort of place where he seems to be bouncing around, but at the same time as he seems to be moving between cells and attracting different patrons and maybe burning bridges as he goes throughout this career, he's also clearly on the hunt for books. He's constantly, it seems, looking for new materials that he can put through his intellectual mill. And who knows how those relationships worked out. I'm doing some work now on what libraries he might have actually had access to, but it seems like a lot of it is happenstance meetings with particular people who have books that they identify might be of interest to him, that sort of thing. He cites texts that we have no other record of circulating in England. It's wild. At this point, historically, it's unusual for a hermit to come out of secular estate, right, as Chaucer's term. Usually we would expect at this point a hermit to be a monk first, or very soon after Rolla's lifetime, they have to get sort of episcopal blessing before they take up this life. Rolla is much more on the model of some of the 12th century hermits, like Godric of Finkel and people like that, and kind of odd in that respect. And also certainly odd to be a hermit who wrote as prolifically as he did.
Isn't it ironic that someone who dedicated himself to an eremitic lifestyle became a kind of tourist attraction? Now, putting myself in the position of the curious passerby, someone uninitiated in Rolla, could you talk a little about the text that he produced and the kind of access that his writings provide into this contemplative lifestyle that he's practicing?
There's a story in the Vita that's contained in the office that Andrew mentioned, where one of his patronesses brings a dinner party into his cell to see him one night, and he's furiously writing. And he doesn't stop writing the whole time they're there, but he also preaches at them while he's writing. And what he's writing and what he's preaching are different things. And I feel like that image is exactly like he's, you know, always be writing seems to be like just the corpus is vast, right?
And what I love about that story is that the thing that he preaches about is about the vanities of the world, which is precisely what the lady of the house and her household guests are doing by coming to see the pet hermit that's like hanging out in the cell doing the spectacular writing task. And he's like furiously doing his work and then offering them a kind of tongue-lashing lecture around why they're being sinful and coming to visit him while he's doing his writing tasks. It's great. It's great.
Yeah. And, you know, not hard to get from there to like, why is it that he kept having to find new patrons? Oh, who knows? But so the corpus is really, really big. And part of that is because he writes in both Middle English and in Latin. Right? And a lot of this is determined by audience. I think of him primarily as a Latin writer, participating in a Latin tradition of contemplative theorizing and meditative practice that goes back to Bernard of Clairvaux and the Victorines. Folks like that. Although he also, like, he's read the Scholastics. I found examples of quotations of Thomas Aquinas in his writings. He seems to be aware of some Bonaventure, I think, as well. So he writes Latin texts that participate in that sort of tradition. He writes exegesis. He writes biblical commentary on the Psalms, on the Apocalypse. He also writes in Latin poetry, and he writes letters of spiritual advice to, it seems, specific individuals that were known to him. Although, of course, at the same time, he anticipates a bigger audience. But the two Latin works for which he is best known in the Middle Ages are his Incendium Amoris, Fire of Love, which is a sort of sprawling reflection on mystical experience and the contemplative life that includes a lot of autobiographical content. That's how we learn about some of his mystical experiences. It begins with this amazing account of how he first felt the heat of divine love burning in his chest, not metaphorically, but for real, but not physically, but not, you know, I felt it. The question of like, what the heck that means occupies that text. And the other big work that he's known for is a much more sort of conventional, schematized account of the properly ordered religious life called the Emendatio Vitae, or the Amendment of Life, which walks a reader through all the steps, basically, from conversion to the world to the last two chapters are on love and on contemplation. But then there's also strange things in his corpus, like over-the-top Latin prose, like the Melos, which is what Andrew has translated.
Yeah. I think there are a couple of things that I think really characterize Rolla's corpus. So absolutely writing across Latin and Middle English, the sort of, you know, language of learning and a sort of emerging language in which the potential for literary expression is really being explored. The variety of genres that he participates in as traditionally sort of mapped onto his corpus is pretty widespread. He writes letters of instruction. He writes autobiographical mystical treatises. He translates the Psalter into Middle English, which becomes the standard translation of the Psalter into the vernacular for the remainder of the Middle Ages. Everybody is effectively reading it. The Lollards pick it up and adapt it for their religious interests. He's writing Passion Meditations. He's writing lyrics in Latin and the vernacular. He's writing commentary on scriptural texts. And what's kind of fantastic is in last, I don't know, 10, 15 years, and looking forward over the next couple of years too, there have been these remarkable projects that have sought to create stronger modern critical editions and translations of many of these texts. So there's now just greater accessibility to a lot of his literature, that especially Latin literature, that we hadn't had before. A lot of the critical work on Rolla historically had focused on his Middle English writings, in part because the Latin writings were so voluminous, in part just because it's harder to work on Latin texts for English-speaking scholars. So there's now potential for sort of reassessing what his corpus is made up of. And I think one thing that we haven't talked about yet, but that is important, and Andrew started in on it when he was describing the Insania Memoris, are the sort of like defining characteristics of Rolla's spirituality, which are ubiquitous across his writings. He is a mystic of sensation. He is not a mystic who disappears into abstraction and tries to strip away the things of the world and negative theology. The only thing you can say of God is that you can't say anything of God, right? Like, that's not him.
Yeah, he never shuts up.
He is a mystic of excess. He is a mystic of the sensory. And so for him, the experiences that he has that confirm to him that he is indeed a kind of elect mystic, that he has been predestined for salvation, and that he speaks from a position of authority, which is a question that you'd asked earlier, right? Where does the authority come from? For him, his authority comes from his sensory experiences, which is a sort of wild thing to claim, that I've had these private physical sensory experiences, and that's what lends me the authority to speak the truth of what spiritual reality is. It's a wild claim. But he has this series of sensory experiences over a period of about, I think it's 3 years and 9 months, 4 years about that, that starts with this experience of heat, of fire that wells up from within. And then after period of 9 months after that first experience of fire, he's in the same chapel singing the Vespers, singing the night psalms. And then all of a sudden he hears streaming from above him the sound of angels singing. And he realizes that everybody else that's around him isn't hearing the same thing. He describes it as a kind of like transformation of his being into music, where everything that formerly he had thought and prayed all of a sudden turns into song. And it never stops. This is kind of the wild, interesting for me as a scholar who thinks about historical sound, one of the most interesting things about him, right? He claims that from that point onwards, he is always either awash in or returning back to the heavens, song, music, singing, and that never leaves him. It phases in and out of audibility because of, you know, he's had a long day journeying on the road and his body is taxed and he can't hear it anymore, but a good night's sleep and it comes back. And this two key experiences also has sort of intermingled in between them an experience of sweetness, a sort of gustatory olfactory experience of sweetness. And so these are the sort of three canonical sensory experiences that get attached to Rollian spirituality: heat, sweetness, and song. Other authors and mystics who write about their experience, who are inside his way of doing mysticism, take these concepts and run wild with them and do really interesting things with him after he dies and his texts start circulating more actively in the 1370s, 1380s. But yeah, these three keystone experiences are like at the heart of Rollian spirituality. And it's fascinating to think about like how one's sensory experiences becomes the wellspring for such profuse literary production and such compelling religious experience and religious practice that has such staying power through the end of the period.
Right. And because it's Rolla, right, he has these experiences. And the first thing he does, apparently, is turn to his books and say, okay, who has written about this? So his biblical commentaries in both Middle English and in Latin are very traditional in a lot of respects. They sort of abridge some standard scholastic sources, but throughout, whenever he finds a verse that sounds like it's related to, you know, burn my heart, O God, right, in the Psalms, like, oh, I know what that means. And all of a sudden you get like an effusion of an original interpretation from him. And one of the things he says in The Fire of Love is, why has nobody else written about this. I know that the great saints of old have experienced this as well, but I guess it's my job to put this down on parchment so other people can know what it is that's happening to them when they experience this, or I can describe it in such a way that will make people want to pursue a contemplative life so they can experience this too. He gets misread in the Middle Ages by critics, and I think he gets misread by some scholars too, of like seeing these things as the goals of the contemplative life. For Vrala, what you're aiming for is union with God. Absolutely. And I don't think he would take issue with any of the ways in which that's described in the, and he builds on the language of 12th century mysticism to describe that. But these epiphenomena are amazing. And these things that you get to experience on the way as signs of your special status are graced gifts from God, I guess would be the way he thinks of them. And he wants to be able to use those to draw readers in as well.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I mean, he uses his language oftentimes in ways that are both aimed at cultivating desire for these experiences and then creating versions of or simulacra of or imitations of what these experiences might be like through rhetorical moves, through intense alliteration, through meter and rhyme that really aim to stoke the reader's sort of affective intensity in ways that are really complex. It circulates through Rolla as a figure who is an object of veneration and favor, but then also through Rolla, through the sensory experience, through the affective sort of investment that ultimately all channels upwards to the divine. Everything is a conduit to head upwards. It's really about how do we stoke up the experiential desire to the highest possible heights that we can get it so that we prepare ourselves for the gracious influx of God's favor.
And so the Emendatio Vitae is unusual in his corpus because he's not a systematic writer. What he tends to do is take up an idea, take up a biblical verse, take up a certain kind of devotional literary tradition, motif, something like that. He puts it through, you know, the Rolla machine for a bit. He does some writing on that and then he moves on to the next one. Right. And like, it's possible to see development over the course of his texts, but a lot of it is like, let's see what I can do with this thing to get you interested in contemplation and get you interested in rejecting the world and change your values and poke at your feelings for a bit. And now let's see if this one works instead.
Wow. You two are great storytellers. As I hear you two talk about the importance of books for Rolla, I can't help but think of another medieval mystic, Marjorie Kemp. The Book of Marjorie Kemp famously opens with that framing narrative where she mentions that she is illiterate. I don't think you can read the Book of Marjorie Kemp without that narrative frame, since it accentuates the nature of her connection to God, a connection that is not mediated through reading scripture, which makes for an even more powerful connection to the divine. So, to stay on Rolla, could you talk about his influence on other mystics around his time? And perhaps I'm thinking here of the anchoress Margaret Kirkby.
Yeah, I mean, the Marjorie Kemp thing is great because we know that she knew Rolla's text. There's a chapter in her book where that poor priest who's working with her, I love imagining what this scene must have been like, but the bibliography of what he has read to her includes Incendium Amoris, right? And David Levinsky has written about this very nicely. It's very clear that these ideas are getting into Marjorie's thinking and are showing up in the book independent of that as well, the way she describes her experiences. So that's certainly there. So the Margaret Kirkby thing is tricky. Margaret Kirkby is a nun of Hampole. We have records, Episcopal registers, of her being enclosed as an anchoress in the last years of Rolla's life. The office of Rolla also includes a discussion of several years before that, an anchoress named Margaret, with whom he has a special relationship and who he heals when she is sick. These two people have been put together, conflated in earlier scholarship. I've been trying to prize them apart a little bit. I think they're probably different people. We know that there was another Margaret at Hampole at the same time. Rolla's Incendium Amoris is translated for an anchoress in 1439 named Margaret. So the idea that there are multiple Margarets is not a hard sell, but I want to try to separate them a bit because that lets us underline the idea that it's not just one woman that he's writing for, right? The creation of his text to support the spiritual lives of these women is great. And like, and when we think of Margaret Kirkby as a Hampole nun who he encourages into the anchoritic life, that really puts him in the position of like the teacher and authority. I would be surprised to find that he did not actually look to that other anchoress, Margaret, the one who he knew earlier in his career, as a sort of spiritual authority as well. I strongly suspect it's a two-way street there. And the enclosed woman is somebody that he goes to for advice and counsel as much as the other way.
When we were talking about this the other day, Andrew, I was really taken by this point. The way that we normally tell the story of Rala is he is the authoritative spiritual counselor to all of these religious women who are inside the institution and doing their thing and need guidance. But to flip that script, what about the spiritual experiences of these women? What if Rala is learning from those spiritual experiences? What if he is as much taking instruction from them? And that really helps us think about women's agency in spiritual traditions, particularly in the north of England, over the latter half of the Middle Ages, right? It puts what Rala is doing in a lineage with some of the early Middle English literatures, right? The Ancre Nuissa and the Catherine group and the Wooing group, and the body of literature that's built around enclosed religious women, and helps us imagine and explore the possibilities for women's spiritual agency and spiritual authority in terms that historically we just haven't been as inclined to notice. You can see the through line there from the sort of collection of Margarets hanging out at the Hampole Priory. And you can see the ways in which those might then provide models or provide inspiration for a figure like Julian of Norwich, for a figure like Marjorie Kemp. It's such an interesting way of reconfiguring what in the scholarship has historically been taken in the kind of power dynamic gendered model of authoritative, agentive male instructor and sort of receptive female devotee.
Like the one thing that he can do, right, that puts him in a certain kind of authoritative position is he has access to a Latin literary tradition that the women do not probably, or at least not as easily or as extensively. And so one of his big Middle English works, Form of Living, is written, and Tim Glover, who contributes to the cluster, has been doing some great work on this lately. What Rala is doing is taking things off of his shelf and putting them into Middle English and packaging this text for someone who doesn't have access to Latin. Nigel Palmer passed away a few years ago. His term for this was access to the world of Latin learning. And that's what Rala is able to do as a service for these women. That Form of Living is written for an anchoress, Margaret, I think probably the one he knew from earlier in his life, although there is one manuscript that says Margaret Kirkby, but that's a later thing. That seems to be his MO. He can mediate a tradition, but even in that text, he says, now you've asked me about this, right? So here's what I can do. Literally, the structuring of this text seems, unless it's a rhetorical performance, seems to be determined by the interests and demands, you might say, of the women that he's writing for.
I've just had a little bit of like synapse fire. So one of the Middle English letters that he writes to the nun of Yeddingham, unnamed nun, Ego Dormio, which is a letter of spiritual counsel in Middle English that describes starting in the secular life, then moving into the monastic life, then moving into the contemplative life. And between each step, he inserts a Middle English lyric to help the reader sort of think through and potentially perform some forms of like affective devotional preparation to move from one stage to the next. But he infamously starts off that letter by saying, I am going to be your pimp to Jesus.
You're pampered. You're go-between.
I'm going to bring you to Jesus's bedside.
I'm wooing you on behalf of Jesus.
Exactly, exactly. And to think about that as a way of thinking about what is happening in the collation, translation, and circulation of Latin materials to a wider audience. To think about translation and to think about the movement from the language of prestige to the language of a wider readership, right? To think about that through the metaphor of wooing you for the divine. I'd never thought of that turn of phrase being connected to his work as a translator, but that could be fun.
It would shock me if these texts, Form of Living, especially his English translation of the Psalter, if those weren't in Julian of Norwich's cell.
Oh, for sure, for sure.
I mean, Julian is not the sort of writer who often reveals her sources directly. Everything that gets written in that text goes through the process of Julianification and rumination, right? But I think that there are images there that suggest she's reflecting on some Rala that she's read.
I think you're tapping into something that is very important, Andrew. In this day and age, as we realize more and more the need to decolonize the materials that we study, your take on influence is particularly refreshing. Instead of imagining Rala as an infallible authority dictating a spiritual life, you see influence more fruitfully, I think, as an ebb and flow. He brings a certain expertise to the conversation, but these women who serve as his interlocutors have their own experiences, which amount to a different kind of authority that is not less valid. Based on their experiences, they are able to articulate probing questions, and as scholars, we know that the question is generally more important than the answer. And as a footnote, Andrew, if this epiphany is what makes you rich and famous, I hope everyone remembers that they heard it here first.
I mean, if you know a way to become rich and famous by landing on a scholarly insight in medieval scholarship, please share that with me. Share that with all of us.
Well, you know, if this idea doesn't bring you fame and fortune, maybe the cluster will.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's turn to that. I'm sure we don't get to see all the work that went into editing this cluster when we see the finished
product. It started before COVID.
Well, it's finally here. So what motivated the cluster? What was the catalyst for it? And in your opinion, what are the key takeaways from the essays?
I'm trying to remember exactly, because it was a while ago that we started on this. I think what happened was that I got my hands on Andrew's translation of Melos, which is a fantastic, successful attempt to reproduce this manneristic alliterative style in English translation. And so, okay, he's working on Rala, and his approach is different than mine. I'm working on Rala. Like, it seems like we know other folks who are doing this. Let's get something together. Let's see if we're at a point in the field where it would be useful to reflect on where we've been and where we're going. And so we started rounding up people for a conference panel. And this started as a panel at the International Pierce Plowman Society in Miami, which is a great place for Pierce Plowman scholars to hang out. It's totally their natural habitat. And I think it was around the same time as we did that panel that I was in Cambridge for Bloomfield seminars. And I happened to be at lunch and saw Sally Spence a couple of tables over at the same restaurant. And I went over, which was annoying. I was at lunch with my parents. And I said, Sally, I just had this great conference panel at this other conference. Does speculum do colloquies or clusters? And she didn't say, go away, I'm eating lunch. She was interested and we chatted for a bit. And then we had to expand from a conference panel to this cluster.
To the question of what is inside the cluster, what does the cluster aim to accomplish? I mean, I think one thing that, as Andrew and I were co-authoring the introduction to the cluster, one thing that really emerged for me was just the diversity of approaches, right? That there are a collection of scholars who are thinking through this like pretty big body of material, which one could come into from any number of perspectives. And part of what the cluster is aiming to do, I think, is to, one, identify a whole bunch of perspectives that practicing scholars now are interested in bringing to the corpus, and then also to point out the ways in which there's lots of open space in that corpus for further work from a variety of critical perspectives and from a variety of disciplines. I think all of us who are contributing to this cluster are literary scholars by training, and that's been the space that Rala has hung out in. It's mostly literary scholars, mostly English literature scholars, but there's so much potential inside this corpus. And we need, I think, in order to explore the corpus responsibly, a much broader sort of conspectus of disciplines, theoretical paradigms, engaging with the material. There's a whole sequence of author portraits that accompany Rala across manuscripts. And it's very clear that some of them are coming from a standard iconography. There's clearly an iconographic type that's connected to Rala. And where that's coming from, what that iconographic type is doing, is it connected to his shrine, which is a major pilgrimage site in the north of England, right? Are there images that are circulating there? So art historians have space here to do some really interesting work. Musicologists have some really interesting space here to do cool work. I've been working on a piece recently that's just been touching pushing the very, very margins of thinking through how Raleighan spirituality, particularly his experience of angelic song, sits in relationship to the Anglo-Norman sequence tradition and the Dulcis Jesu Memoria, which has a music setting from the 12th, 13th century. So there's musical materials that are circulating in England, which, you know, in terms of corpus, the English corpus of surviving notated music is comparatively low, especially for this part of the period. And so thinking, you know, how do we step outside of the notated corpus into these kinds of texts that are thinking about musical experience and sonic experience in order to expand the sets of conversations we can have. So I think musicologists have a ton of space here to work.
Well, let me add an example to that. His one major standalone Latin poem, he embeds a lot of Latin poetry into his prose, but his one major standalone Latin poem is a song in praise of the Virgin Mary. And he goes through in a standard meter for him, Galliardic quatrains. And then at the end of it, he changes the meter slightly and he quotes Zelo tui langueo. He quotes the tenor of a polyphonic motet that is extant and notated. I am not qualified to say what that move is, and we need to get by with some help from our friends in cases like this. I can tell you about the circulation, I can tell you about the manuscripts that preserve it, but what he's doing with that move of having the poetry end with something that is notated and would potentially be recognizable as a sort of allusion there is wild. There's so much more that needs to be done about him. Andrew's contribution to the cluster, he gives us a reading of a text that I think like hasn't received any kind of close reading, any interpretation before this. Like, it's wild. Like, there are things in this corpus that need their first, the blush of critical attention. And there are things that have been studied intensely for decades that are still repaying new approaches.
I think this is one space, too, where even stuff that's been thought through for a good long while stands to really benefit from a variety of critical vantages and paradigms and sort of theoretical approaches that folks are, I think, keenly interested in right now. Adam Lears recently published a piece on reading Rolla through new materialism, thinking past the anthropocentric and thinking about post-human approaches to Rolla's corpus and Rolla's spirituality. There's some really interesting space, I think, for actually locating Rolla's mysticism inside sort of more broadly conceptualized global mystical traditions. His spirituality in many ways resembles forms of mystical spirituality coming from the Byzantine East. And I don't think that anyone would want to make a strong claim for direct influence, but to think comparatively around what's going on, I mean, his cult is very much attached to devotion to the holy name and the centrality of the Jesus prayer for Eastern mystical traditions chimes really, really well with that. The way that he uses sound effects in his prose and in his verse can fit in really interesting ways with Eastern theologies of the icon. So there's lots of space there too, I think, for encountering Rolla from perspectives from which we wouldn't normally anticipate encountering him. But when you sort of meet the literature with those perspectives in place, I think there's so much to work with. There's so much to encounter and really discover.
Another sort of perspective there that is really important brings us back to what you were asking before about the cantankerous hermit who wants to be left alone, right? This is somebody whose authority gets conveyed through intermediaries necessarily. Even in his own lifetime, he is writing in lieu of interacting with people in large part. And this is what Kathy Zeman does really, really nicely in our cluster to pay attention to the question of how the intermediating work of manuscripts and the sort of the copying and preparation of his text is trying to cultivate a sense of charismatic presence in absence. I mean, that's necessitated after he dies, obviously, but absence that's there even in his lifetime.
Before signing off, could you give us a glimpse into the essays of the cluster?
So Andrew and I offer an introduction that tries to sort of orient the reader in terms of who Rolla is, what his reputation is, and how he has been studied since roughly the 1890s, when his work started getting printed in things that we would recognize as scholarly sources. Then we start with two essays that really focus on readings of his works, with Tim Glover offering a really useful reassessment of autobiographical reflections and the sort of personality of Rolla that is that comes through in his writings. Tim puts these in a rhetorical tradition, and he tries to identify these as strategies that Raleigh uses to cultivate certain effects at specific moments in the text. Kathy Zeman then walks us through several moments in Raleigh's office, in the life of Raleigh that we have, and tries to get at the question of what kind of charismatic authority was cultivated in his cult, and then in his writings, as I was saying. That's followed by me talking about Raleigh's access to books, and what kinds of books he might have been able to read, and what kinds of books he wrote. And I'm trying to get there at the idea that an eremitic figure, a guy who's a peripatetic hermit, probably knew that he did not have consistent access to a large library. He is not a monastic writer, and it seems like he is doing a lot of work as he writes, quoting sources that he wants to return to later. He's always, it seems to me, writing for himself as a future writer. He wants to take notes for future use, and these things are also his works.
One way to characterize the second set of essays in the cluster is to think about reception, the ways that Raleigh's texts were circulated, used, made sense of by readers, both medieval and contemporary. So we start with Anne Killian, who provides us with a reading of the circulation of Raleigh's Middle English lyrics without a sort of explicit mention of his name in the spaces where they're getting anthologized. So what happens when we take Raleighan materials, Raleighan lyrics, and remove the authorial attribution that carries so much authority? How do those lyrics change in the ways that they make meaning when they're put in conversation with other kinds of devotional material without the author's name attached to them? We then have Tekla Buda's contribution, which is connected to a chapter from her book, Sonic Bodies, which is fantastic. The chapter is thinking through the uptake that Raleighan style and spirituality has among a pair of Carthusian brothers, Richard Methley and John Norton, who write almost in parallel spiritual journals, spiritual biographies that exhibit really striking structural parallels, really striking stylistic parallels that are very clearly drawing on Raleigh's literature, Raleigh's way of practicing and putting into the written word his sort of devotional fervor. They're very clearly picking up on that style and putting it to new and really interesting uses that help us think about what spirituality in the communal corporate space of the charter house might look like and how Raleigh might support that kind of a spiritual life, which is very different from the solitary spiritual life that he builds for himself. And then at the very end of the cluster, we have my piece, which is trying to theorize what Raleigh might do for us if we're thinking about sound art, which is a contemporary artistic practice. Sound installation art gets theorized by a philosopher of sound art, Salome Vogelin. And I take that set of philosophical writings and sort of notice how strikingly they map onto Raleigh's descriptions of his own experience of having heard angelic song for the first time, and then try to practice a style of reading, a style of interpretation that really zeroes in on sound as the material that, as I kind of argue, is the primary material, the primary medium of Raleigh's crafted life, both in his writing, in his sort of eremitic lifestyle, and the religious spaces that he's moving through. So it's really an attempt to think through how might sound lead us through Raleigh's corpus.
And we end with an afterword by Nicholas Watson, who wrote the sort of bio-bibliography of Raleigh back in the 90s, Richard Raleigh and the Invention of Authority, which is one of the first like attempts to do a reading of his corpus. Nicholas knows this stuff better than anybody. And so to have him reflect on where the scholarship has been and where it's going is really, really valuable piece. And he gives us this wonderful pair of images that for thinking about Raleigh, right? The nightingale and the cuckoo. Both of these things are descriptive of the kind of writer Raleigh is. He is the lyric, you know, ornamented, attractive nightingale singing prettily, but he's also the workaday cuckoo, right? He's doing both of these things in his corpus at different times. And that seems to have been so important for how he was taken up and how he became such an influential writer.
This has been so much fun. Thank you, Andrew and Andrew, for making the time to talk with us.
Thank you. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. This has been fun.
Many thanks to John, Andrew, and Andrew for that lively conversation reassessing Richard Raleigh.
Let me thank the MMA series producers, William Beatty, Jonathan Correa-Reyes, Reed O'Mara, and Logan Quigley.
I'd also like to acknowledge the members of the Speculum Editorial Board, along with the Speculum staff, Taylor McCall, Carol Anderson, and Esther German, and the Medieval Academy of America for its continued sponsorship.
Music for the MMA is by Anna O'Connell. I'm Catherine Jansen, editor of Speculum, a journal of medieval studies. Speculum is the journal of the Medieval Academy of America and is published by the University of Chicago Press. One of the perks of joining the Medieval Academy is receiving both the print and digital editions of the journal. Online, you can find us at www.journals.uchicago.edu/talk/SPC/current. Till next time.